हिंदी में ब्रॉडकास्ट करेंगे। जवाहरलाल नेहरू।
भाइयों और बहनों, आज मैं कुछ आपसे जनरल इलेक्शंस यानी जो चुनाव होने वाला है उसके बारे में कुछ कहा चाहता हूँ। आप सबों को इसमें दिलचस्पी है और दिलचस्पी होनी चाहिए। अव्वल तो ये कि इतना बड़ा चुनाव जिसमें इतने लोग शामिल हों आज तक दुनिया में कहीं नहीं हुआ। दूसरे ये कि बहैसियत एक नागरिक भारत के आपको इसमें दिलचस्पी लेनी चाहिए, क्योंकि इसके नतीजे से ये तय होगा कि हिंदुस्तान का भविष्य क्या होगा। प्रजातंत्र यानी डेमोक्रेसी के लिए ये ज़रूरी है कि जनता पूरी तौर से दिलचस्पी ले उन बड़े सवालों में जो देश के सामने हैं और ऐसे इलेक्शन में जिसका नतीजा होता है कि गवर्नमेंट कैसे बने।
साल था 1951, India's first elections were supposed to happen, and Jawaharlal Nehru was the biggest leader in India at that point, chose Phulpur as his constituency. But this episode is not about him. This episode is about the man who decided to give Jawaharlal Nehru a run for his money, or at least thought so. This story is about a Baba, a Mauni Baba, a Baba who decided that he will run against Nehru and who hoped that he will beat Nehru, ended up getting less than 10% of the vote casted from that city or from that constituency, yet created a legacy that still is alive today. Here is a passage from the Time magazine, issue January 28, 1952. By plane, ship, train, automobile and bullock cart, India's Prime Minister Jawaharlal Nehru had been campaigning all over the country, stirring up votes for India's four-month-long first general election. He had travelled 23,000 miles, made as many as 10 speeches a day, addressed 5 million people. In fact, he had been just about everywhere, but in his own constituency in Allahabad. There was no need to canvass Allahabad, he said rather airily. Last week, he got a distressing news. His only opponent in Allahabad, a 52-year-old Prabhudatt Brahmachari, who wears a luxuriant grey beard, orange and red-rimmed spectacles, a saffron robe and a long white loincloth, had been quietly building up the vote. Quietly was the word for it. He had done it without uttering a single word, except an occasional loud laugh. One plank. Back in 1921, Brahmachari, like Nehru, came under the spell of Mahatma Gandhi. But Brahmachari became a sadhu. He took vows of silence and celibacy, was jailed several times by the British, once along with Nehru, set up a camp on the banks of River Ganga to study the Hindu epics, and wrote the first 60 volumes of a 180-volume biography of Hindu god Krishna. One day last October, he cried out, "Hey Nath Narayan," meaning, "O Lord God," the holy man's only departure from silence. And an attendant brought him his Schaefer fountain pen and paper. He wrote, "If today I participate in an election, it's because my inner voice bids me to do so." Nehru, he said, is a black Englishman who studied in the West. Holy man Brahmachari toured Nehru's constituency in a 1931 Dodge sedan, accompanied by a troupe of Hindu singers, to the chanting of Hindu shlokas. He danced on the platform, rhythmically tapping a pair of small brass cymbal, shankh. A disciple read from the pamphlet he had written. Hearing that Brahmachari's pamphlet had sold 76,000 copies, Nehru came rushing back to Allahabad last week. The article adds, "This week, as Allahabad voters went to the polls, Nehru seemed to have his constituency under control again. The whole country was pretty much his too." So yes, the man who was standing against Nehru was Prabhudatt Brahmachari, an independent candidate. But independent only in name, kyunki All India Hindu Mahasabha, Akhil Bhartiya Ram Rajya Parishad and Bhartiya Jansangh, all the three Hindu nationalist parties supported him. In fact, before signing in for the election, he met Golwalkar a number of times and got his blessings to run against Nehru. Similarly, Akhil Bhartiya Ram Rajya Parishad's leader Acharya Karpatri Maharaj, another major icon in the Hindu conservative pantheon, actually urged him to fight against Nehru. So this was the only individual who was standing against Nehru, and this was the only individual who had as the Hindu right thought, some chance against him. What was his election plank and why is it important today? So there were essentially two things that he was fighting against when he was fighting against Nehru. Number one was the Hindu Court Bill. The Hindu Court Bill was essentially a bill that had been in works since, well, some part of it have been in work since 1891 at the least. In 1891, the British India government put forth the Age of Consent Bill, which increased the age of consent for Hindu women or girls from 10 to 12. This happened because there was a case of marital rape against a 10-year-old Phulomani Das in Bengal. Usually the British government in India would not really meddle into the affairs of the locals. But in this case, they thought that it was important because it was just so like dastardly, the act that had happened. The man, her husband, was in his 30s. When the bill was put forth, many icons, for example, Lokmanya Tilak, Ishwar Chandra Vidyasagar, opposed the bill. They opposed the idea of increasing the age of consent from 10 to 12.
And on the other side, there were people like Gopal Krishna Gokhale, who was also mentor of Gandhi, who supported the bill.
Then in 1929, there came Sharda Act, which increased the age of consent from 12 to 16. Again, similar level of opposition happened. One of the primary quote-unquote reason for the opposition was ki, how can you tell us how to do our religion? You are an outsider.
At that point of time, during the Sharda Act, Gita Press, Gorakhpur, which had become a much known quantity, most of North India, it remained silent on the subject. So it did not say anything. However, Hanuman Prasad Poddar, who edited Kalyan up until 1971, he wrote in a letter to Gita Press's founder, Jayadayal Goenka, that I'm a big opponent of this law, not only because it relates to the age of girls, but due to its interference in religious matters. There is a need to get this law revoked so that in future no need is felt to legislate on such matters. To break the law and go to jail is the only way. I think opposing the legislation from a social and religious perspective would not help. The law has to be opposed politically.
In 1941, the British government created a committee which was for the Hindu Reform Bill. It was chaired by an individual whose name was B.N. Rao. In 1944, the committee put forth its ideas. And 1948, it went under review. Remember, by then, India had had elections, although it was still British India. And Nehru was the Prime Minister even before we became fully independent, right? But in 1948, after we became independent, it was put forth. And there was a lot of opposition. Nehru's hope was that after he wins the election in 1952, he will get that done. He, in fact, in 1950, in February 1950, he writes a letter to Sardar Patel, jahan pe he says that how lonely he is feeling within his own cabinet. By this time, Sardar Patel, who dies later that year, was very sick. He was coughing blood. So he was not actively participating in the activities of the cabinet. So back to Prabhudat Maharaj. The Hindu Court Bill was opposed by the Hindu right, primarily because it contained a few key things like allowing intercaste marriages, allowing a separate provision in marriage, which allowed for divorces in case of infidelity. It also allowed for the division of property from a father to all his kids equally. The opposition came from many different areas. For example, one of the stalwarts from Jharkhand, Ramanarayan Singh, said that this will only create further rifts in the family, and this is again, religion should reform from within itself, and the only thing that will help the women folk of our country is love. Then Harivishnu Kamath from Hoshangabad, another member of parliament, he said, what is next? Will polygamy be allowed? I mean, the polygamy, polyandry, everything should be allowed if you are allowing divorce. Long story short, this became one of the primary poll planks against Nehru.
In August 1946, Goenka wrote an article in Kanyar titled Hindu Vivah Ki Pavitrata Evam Tat Sambandhi, in which he argued that such independence is not promised to women in Hindu social structure. A woman has to live with her father till marriage, with her husband as a married woman, and after his demise, she has to live either with her son or some other relative. She cannot be independent at any cost. These are not paraphrasing.
Now, why is Kalyan important? Is because Kalyan was not considered like the prime of Hindi literature at that point, but it was still the most read Hindi magazine, especially its Nari Ank, and it still carried a lot of weight. It still does potentially, but also most prominent leading individuals who wrote in Hindi, from Rajendra Prasad to Nirala, Pant, Vajpayee, Mahavir Prasad Dwivedi, Pitambar Dutt, Bhattatwal, and Prabhudatt Brahmachari, all wrote for Kalyan. And Kalyan was the medium of propaganda for the Hindu conservative forces through the 20s, but especially in the 40s and right after the 40s, in the 50s. In the 1940s, as the prospect of independence and partition became real, the focus of Gita Press and Kalyan turned entirely political, reporting and interpreting events through communal prism. They, in fact, right before the 1952 election, they asked people to not vote for Nehru and Ambedkar specifically, because they were the people who brought forth the Hindu Code Bill. Their literature about Hindu women openly preached and glorified practices of sati. To the question, is sati pratha proper or improper, their answer is, a wife's cremation with the dead body of her husband on the funeral pyre is not a tradition. She in whose mind truth and enthusiasm come burns even without fire, and she does not suffer any pain while she burns. This is not a tradition that she should do so, but this is her truth, righteousness, and faith in scriptural decorum. It means that it is not just a tradition, it is a religion. On this topic, actually, Prabhudatt Brahmachari has written a book whose title is Cremation of a Wife with Her Husband's Dead Body is the Backbone of Hindu Religion, and it should be studied. Now I will let you kind of decide if the opposition by the Hindu right to Hindu Code Bill was right or not. One legitimate criticism of the Hindu Code Bill was that it was just for Hindus. There is no such code bill for Muslims. And why was the government of the day interfering only in the Hindu affairs, which is a fair point. And there are many different ways that people can respond to it. But if we look at what Nehru was thinking, his idea was that we have just gone through a partition and there is a substantial number of minorities who have decided to live in this India, and immediately doing something like this will needlessly make them afraid of this India. And the idea was to allow this new minority or this new Muslim population in India, which is not new but coming from like this massive shock of partition, to allow time for them to settle down before anything of that sort is done. And Nehru also deeply believed, and again you can debate if it is right or wrong, but he deeply believed that the 80% population, the 80 plus percent majority Hindu population, should set an example for all the minority communities by showing that they can reform themselves, which shows these other communities that maybe that is something that they should undertake themselves to. So that was his reason for Hindu Code Bill being for the Hindus only, and there being no Muslim Code Bill or Christian Code Bill. This is, of course, a question that is still asked, and this is also like one of the big things for which Nehru is called pseudo-secular, appeasement politics, all that. The second thing was cow protection. The interesting thing is that if you look at from the time that Nehru gains prominence and from the time it becomes that Nehru will be one of the biggest leaders in the Indian political scene.
On the religious side, that's a very satisfactory, sounds to me, an optimistic statement. But on the main trouble there's been in India, I'll put it this way, you have said in the past that you wanted to make India a secular democracy in which minorities could live at peace. Mm. Now, do you feel, I regard that as one of your principal objectives, do you feel that you have achieved that that religious fanaticism has gone down now. Do you feel on top of that problem?
Well, we are on top of it, but I can't say that we've put an end to it. Mm. And we have to face it even now often enough. But the last elections showed that the Indian people generally don't like it.
What starts to happen is that pamphlets start going around about how Nehru eats beef and pork. I mean, things that have that are still being said about him. And he maybe he did. But there was a time when these sadhus actually, right in 1947, a group of sadhus met Nehru around cow protection. And Nehru asked them, then why do you guys keep telling everybody that I eat beef? And they said, we don't say it. It's we don't know who says it. So it's interesting that already kind of this is being used as a plank. Is there any mention in the Hindu religion about beef being, or cow meat being non-prescribed? We cannot be sure. Sanskrit scholar Rajni K. Dixit says there is no such thing as holy cow in the Vedas. The Vedas consider bovines important for milk, beef, agriculture and transport, but not divine or holy. The word Agnya applies only to a milch cow because it is not economical to kill it. A Vaish cow is meant for beef and especially reserved to an extent for Brahmins only. Atharva 12.4.13 tells us that in case a Brahmin begs for a cow from a non-Brahmin, even if that person has a beef dinner at his house, he has to select another cow to slaughter for his own dinner than the one that is asked for. The word Agnyana, not to be killed, coined by Rig Veda for young milch cows, was the main cause of the Hindu misunderstanding that cows or bovines are not to be slaughtered. The Rig Veda has never used the word mother for cow. There is no punishment recommended for a cow slaughterer, even if someone kills a young milch cow. Beef eating is also not taboo. Beef parties are not allowed but highly appreciated. Not only allowed but highly appreciated. And a person who cooks beef for his guests is praised by the term Atithi Guha, one who offers beef to guests. Adi Shankaracharya, born in 788 CE in Kerala, in his commentary on Brihadaranyaka Upanishad says, Odan, rice mixed with meat, is called Mansodan. On being asked whose meat it should be, he answers Uksha, which means ox, which is capable to produce semen. Currently, 72 communities, including some upper caste Hindus in Kerala, prefer beef to the mutton, and some prefer it because it is cheaper than mutton. Hinduism's great proponent Swami Vivekananda said, you will be surprised to know that according to ancient Hindu rites and rituals, a man cannot be a good Hindu who does not eat beef. Savarkar himself said that when humanitarian interests are not served and in fact harmed by the cow, and when humanism is shamed, self-defeating extreme cow protection should be rejected. Now, that is for the reference. The belief in Hindus is that cow is holy. One of the things that is not mentioned in this is when Babur comes to India and becomes the king, he actually bans the killing of cow during Eid. Akbar reaffirms the ban, and Shah Alam II also reaffirms the ban later in the Mughal years. It was only during when the East India Company rule that beef slaughter becomes much more common. And largely, there was, like, even though when Nehru was Prime Minister, the state governments in Madhya Pradesh, Rajasthan, Bihar and Maharashtra, in all of these states, beef slaughter was banned, even though there was Congress government that was part of the setup there. However, that did not stop Prabhudat Brahmachari or people like Acharya Karpatri Maharaj to say that their opposition to Nehru was because of his allowing of beef slaughter or the Hindu court bill. Anyway, everyone knew that Nehru will win the elections, and so he did. He won more than close to 75% of the votes cast in his constituency. What happens to Prabhudat Brahmachari after the elections is the first instance of us hearing about him again is in 1955, when a Patna police superintendent files a case where they talk about how a few individuals, including Savarkar and other folks from Hindu Mahasabha and Akhil Bhartiya Ramraja Parishad were found to kind of gather and talk about some cow vigilantism action that would be done starting in 1955 into 1957 for the next 2 years, because according to them, every year in the Hindu history from 1657, 1857, 1857 has had some sort of revolution. So 1957 should as well. Also, 1957 is the year that the second Lok Sabha elections would happen. However, outside of that, nothing really happened beyond a few disruptive cases in Patna and central provinces. In 1966, Prabhudat Brahmachari forms a group which is called SGSS. It's essentially what its name is Sarvadaliya Goraksha Mahabhyan Samiti. So SGMS, not SGAS. SGMS. And interestingly, he does a hunger strike and around on 7th November 1966, around 7 lakh, well, that number can be contested, a number of people come to Delhi. This is long after Nehru has passed away. And the situation turned out of control, and there were reports of vandalism. Police resorted to firing, resulted in 6 or 7 sadhus dying. Many sadhus were imprisoned. Home Minister Gulzari Lal Nanda had to resign from his post. In 1967, he went on an indefinite fast on the issue of cow slaughter. He broke the fast after 80 days. In 1966, when Vishwa Hindu Parishad is formed, he's one of the individuals who's out there on the stage participating in it. The Hindu Code Bill was later submitted in four divisions and was finalized by 1955-56. But the topic of Hindu Code Bill never died, and the discussions around Uniform Civil Code is how we hear about it. Interestingly, the same people who opposed the 1891 Act and then the Sharda Act around the fact that outsiders cannot define our law said, when in an independent India was trying to do Hindu Code, about how the religion should itself decide what it should, which is in most cases is an excuse. But these same people, as they gained massive power, as they have gained massive power now, did not do the same thing and allowed for a number of Muslim laws like triple talaq to go through. Cow and UCC, still two of the biggest things that drive the Hindu right in India. And it is no surprise that even in our first election, it was still driving all of us. VHP is still there. Prabhudat Brahmachari died in 1990 at the ripe age of 105. His one dream was to see a Hanuman Mandir in Delhi. He called it the Kotwal of Delhi, because he had seen a dream that Delhi will be protected by Hanuman. So back then, near Palam Airport, there's still this temple which is called Kotwal of Delhi. It's a Hanuman temple. Interestingly, unrelated, but when the Nehru family first came to Delhi, it was Nehru's grandfather, Gangadhar Nehru, who actually joined Delhi, who actually came to Delhi because his position was the city Kotwal of Delhi.
In Delhi, one of the candidates was a Congress Party Sikh who made impressive use of bicycles and other means of transport for his campaign. There are about 1 million voters in Delhi out of a total Indian electorate of well over 170 million men and women. It's a 3-month affair, and Mr. Nehru, who's travelled thousands of miles through the country, has of course been campaigning for Congress, as well as urging the people to exercise their new democratic right to vote.
Long years ago, we made a trip with destiny, and now the time comes when we shall redeem our pledge.
Sanmaniya Adarniya Didi.
Didi. Hum Hindustani